Acquisition number 12021, Reel 2.
Mr. Fred Lewis, Reel 2.
For the elimination of communist terrorism in Malaya.
Did you personally meet Sir Gerald Templar?
On many occasions, he visited our camp at Labis. So we were on an estate, the Johor Labis estate, which was a great big, or 20,000 acres of rubber and oil palm belonging to Société Financière de Plantation de Terre Rouge, a big French company. We had an airstrip up there, and of course he'd come in by helicopter. I found him most heartening. I remember particularly on one occasion when he arrived with General Huey Stockwell, who I served under in Burma, and his armoured car was waiting at the airstrip and we picked him up there. He first started off when his helicopter landed. He said to me, "It looks a bit lonely here, you know, I am after all the High Commissioner and it wouldn't be a very good thing if I got killed." So I blew a whistle and somewhere in the neighbourhood of about 60 extremely well-armed men appeared from the bushes, which was all just SOP, if you like, standard operational procedure. We then put him in his armoured car and with our Land Rovers took him down to the camp headquarters and we had a small guard of honour done up in the traditional Malayan police way. He looked at this and said, "F *K, he was a man of strong language, to a guard of honour," he said to Huey Stockwell. And so he said, "Bit of a waste of time, isn't it?" Anyway, he had a look at them and said they were very smart. And then we took them to the base of resistance, which was five communists we'd knocked off the night before. So all was well. He spent considerable time in our mess, and there was a senior police officer from Johor with him. And General Templar looked at the walls of our mess, which were plastered with weapons, flags, all sorts of impedimenta which we'd liberated from a communist enemy. And he had sent out an order at one stage, under his name, that all recovered enemy equipment would be sent back to Kuala Lumpur again for analysis and all the rest of it. He said, "Don't see much chance of my orders being obeyed." And of course the senior police officer, who was somewhat nervous, immediately whipped out his notebook in a typical police fashion and said, "I shall see that ASP Lewis is severely disciplined for this breach." He said, "Don't be silly." He said, "They're killing bandits." So he and Huey Stockwell drank another half bottle of gin between them, by which time the skies had cleared and they went on their way rejoicing. He came on other occasions. I met him several times when I was running a jungle training school at Sungibulo and Dusuntura, when I was personally responsible on his instructions for keeping a very close interest and supervision of the training of the Special Operation Volunteer Force, which was a brainchild of Field Marshal Sir Gerald Templar, recently surrendered enemy personnel, bandits from the jungle, who were fit and willing and able to fight against their former compatriots, were taken to Sungibulu or Dusuntura, giving an infantry soldier's training, a fairly rash course, put under the command of either a Chinese-speaking police lieutenant or a Chinese inspector, and went back into the jungle, into their old haunts, with a view, of course, to knocking off their comrades. I must say, in retrospect, they were not a great success. The time lapse between getting them on the ground again was so great that the terrorists tended to move out. But it did have some successes.
Were they keen to operate against their comrades?
Well, they said so. Some of them, the a thing that used to upset the Chinese, on the whole, a very intelligent, logical race, and bitterly resent injustices with the punishments they were made to endure by their guerrilla leaders, who, you know, a little power corrupts, absolute power, life and death corrupted absolutely, and they behaved like little Hitlers. And I think that had a lot to do with it. We had many other times when we've had a communist come straight out of the jungle. We fed him up, armed him and taken him on the range and then gone out, and he's taken us to the camp and we've, you know, destroyed it and the people in it. Yes, I must admit, I have tremendous feeling of respect for Templar, the man's man, and I think that he could see through the flannels, and he really, I think he, to a great degree, tremendous achievement wrapping up in Malaya, because the thing was that he also started preparing people for a handover. And by and large, I think the Malays, it cut the ground from under the feet of the communist terrorists, because we were getting ready to hand over to an elected government.
Who were the flannelers?
Oh, I think the civil servants everywhere. A lot of people who push paper from the in-tray to the out-tray, I suppose. You obviously get them everywhere. And I think that they tended to try and impose their own ideas, which were very often quite wrong, onto Templar, who was a clean wind from outside, and who had considerable achievements as a soldier, a very great soldier. He knew the world as it was, and he wasn't putting up with any of that nonsense. Added to which, I think he'd been exceptionally well briefed. And, of course, Churchill had virtually made him dictator of Malaya. I mean, there was no question, if two officials disagreed, a policeman perhaps and a member of the Legislative Council, if they didn't kiss and make up, they were both on the next plane. The same applied to the army, too. Any generals who had any funny ideas, they had to toe the party line. Of course, with the Templar, it wasn't difficult with the military, because, after all, he was a field marshal and a very experienced one. I always felt, in retrospect, a little hard on General Briggs, who's another of my favourite generals. Again, I served with him in Burma. I'm not in any way denigrating the efforts of Templar, but Briggs had started a lot of this, and he was there at a bad time, when there wasn't much backup being given, and we weren't very well equipped, and we were having a lot of failures. But he originally thought of the villagization. He started that, the new villages.
What kind of bad ideas do you think that the civil service were trying to impose on Templar?
Well, I think they didn't like his tough attitude. They didn't like the idea of villagers, for example, being punished. The villagers lived under a curfew and were living on basic food and water when they were being punished for giving aid and succour to the communist terrorists. And until somebody put in an anonymous letter into a box which was prominently displayed saying who done what, they were held that way. And I think a lot of the old Malayan civil servants didn't think that was the right way to go on. They thought it was too dictatorial and arbitrary.
What do you think the genuine, true attitude of the villagers was towards the guerrillas? Do you think they supported them or opposed them?
Well, the guerrillas were Chinese, the villagers were Chinese. Racially, nationally, they must have had strong feeling towards the guerrillas. Added to which, the Chinese, who were basically responsible for the wealth of Malaya and do a lot of the work, had always felt that the Malays, the sons of the soil, the Bumiputra, were in a very privileged position, basically because the occupying power, the British, really preferred the Malays to the Chinese because they were nicer people. And I think there was always that. Added to which, let's be fair, the Japanese gave the Chinese a dreadful time. The Malays, let it be said, a lot of them did collaborate, and so did the Indians. And the only people who fought the Japanese were the Malayan People's Anti-Japanese Army, which of course now is called the MRLA, or was called the MRLA then. So you had this feeling of sentiment. Added to which, the next most important thing was fear. Because Templar got over that by garrisoning the new villages with special constabulary and a home guard. So that the fact that they'd be brutally executed for not helping the terrorists, that factor was to a great extent eliminated.
But what about the communistic aspect of the guerrillas? Did that appeal or put off the Chinese?
Well, I don't think they properly understood it. I would have thought that communism is not a thing the Chinese like, but having said that, there's an awful lot of Chinese in China who are communist. It would go against all Chinese religious and family things. I don't think that people who were living not too well would have really worried too much about the politics. They, I think, basically by and large, would have preferred the Chinese to dominate Malaya rather than the Malays or Indians.
Did any Chinese discuss this type of thing with you, perhaps Chinese in the police force?
Oh, yes. They were all pretty... They were very much against communism. They had to be quite well educated, at least a sort of school certificate of matric to get into the police force anyway, especially as officers. But they were all adamant about one thing. It was time that the British left. The amount of face lost by our shameful defeat in Singapore was so great that no way the British could ever pose again as a big imperial power in the Far East. We'd had it. They'd seen our people, highest ranks down, been used as coolies, been beaten up, been humiliated, so on and so forth. And that was it. You could never get back to the old status quo before the Japs came.
So these Chinese would say to you, when are you British going, would they?
Oh, yes, indeed, yeah. I had very many friends amongst them. I had a lot of time. I have a great admiration and respect for the Chinese. Very hard-working, good, tough people, and very sincere, too, on the whole, I found. I had some very, very good friends who, at that time, it might have meant their death.
So would you visit their homes?
Oh, yes, quite regularly.
But were the Chinese not worried about increased Malay domination when the British left?
Yes, I think they were. And you will recall that there have been some nasty riots. I think... I don't know. I think that Tunku Abdul Rahman, who I believe was the first president... boss of Malaya after we left. He was very good. He was a very highly intelligent, well-educated gentleman. And I think that, on the whole, he bent over backwards to be all things to all people in Malaya. But I think since then, they've become a little bit more, how shall I say, radical in their outlook, especially this religious tendency which is beginning to grip Malaya again, or Malaysia.
So when these Chinese would say to you, when are you British leaving, in what sense would you reply to them?
Well, you'd say, well, we finished the emergency. When we finished with the communist terrorists, and they would agree wholeheartedly. They'd been fighting against them. They would have been in a rather parlous position if we just scuttled. In fact, I think a lot of them thought we might scuttle because we... more or less the beginning of the scuttle, so we'd left India already. That was another thing I think that contributed to our our position, the fact that we'd got out of India. Look at the dreadful mess there was in India too, you see. I think they thought about all these things, but the point was that I think they all wanted independence. There was no doubt whatsoever about that.
You were talking about the economic damage that was wreaked. Did you feel that that was very severe?
I think in the beginning it was severe, but I think, again, I don't have any statistics to mind, but I think from about 52, 53 on, when the terrorists were beginning to be driven back into deep jungle because they couldn't sustain being out in the open without getting done, things began to recover. The trouble was that in the early days, the terrorists were all virtually on the out of the jungle and were dominating whole areas. But bit by bit, as the British and the Gurkhas, well, not the Gurkhas, they knew jungle law already, but as the British National Servicemen learned jungle law, it began to be a bit dangerous, and large numbers were killed. Camps were destroyed, and there were long-distance patrols. Then, of course, the most wonderful thing that ever came to Malaya was the helicopter. And the Pioneer aircraft. Now, the Pioneer aircraft made by Scottish Aviation came in two models. One was a single engine, we used to know it affectionately as a single pin, to take about five passengers and a pilot. It could land and take off on a 100-yard strip. Of course, the helicopter could go anywhere. I mean, a strip cleared down to about ground level, 50 yards in diameter, a helicopter could land there. And of course, these came into their own in a really big way for casualty evacuation. Prior to the helicopters coming, the fate of somebody seriously wounded was to be carried out in a sort of improvised hammock out of the jungle. But as soon as we got the choppers, mostly at that time flown by the Royal Navy, the drill used to be, if you had a casualty evacuation, you'd send a signal for a drop of explosives. You'd have about 500 pounds of plastic explosive, 200 pounds of aminol, a Dunarm power saw, and a lot of spare parangs, and then you would start blowing down trees in the vicinity of where the Kazivak was. You'd chop up the trees with the Dunarm saw, you'd blow out their roots, and in 24 hours you could produce an oval-shaped clearing in the jungle, which was cleared for 30 yards down to ground level, and for further 20 around the perimeter to 4-foot level. And of course you could bring a helicopter in to take out the Kazivak. That made a tremendous difference. We used to run operational use of helicopter courses, demolitions, at Tujusan Tur and Sungi Bulo training camps. I initially was in charge of it because I had considerable experience of demolitions, and I went and did a course with the SAS, and then I trained my own people. And, of course, our officers. Well, that made a tremendous difference.
Who trained you in the SAS?
Oh, I think, as I remember, it was a sapper sergeant attached to them. I can't remember his name. It's a long, long time ago.
Was bombing the jungle of much use?
Only if you had a very specific pinpoint target and it was done quickly. And you use very big bombs. The initial bombing, which they used to do in the early days, in 1950, complete waste of time. I think that Gopeng Tun, strangely enough, was killed in a bombing raid on a big camp somewhere in Negri Sembilan.
You were mentioning earlier these, when you were talking about Gopeng Tun, the specific unit that he belonged to. How good was the intelligence about the enemy? Did you regularly know the names?
Not until about 50-51. when tremendous emphasis was placed on bringing in intelligence experts for special branch, and also large numbers of officers who were selected for special branch training were taught Chinese up at the Cameron Highlands School, police, a school up there, police school. Yes, we did. We had very, very good information indeed. I mean, any surrendered enemy personnel, captured enemy personnel, euphemism for terrorists, they were immediately interrogated by a Chinese-speaking officer, either Chinese or an Englishman or a Malay, and usually that person would be accompanied by an earlier terrorist who'd surrendered to give the man a certain amount of confidence and tell him that, show him that they were being well treated and well looked after, and that if they collaborated with the security forces they might escape the death penalty, which of course is mandatory for being an armed terrorist. Yes, we have very good information indeed. That was one of the very big things.
Where did most of the intelligence come from?
Well, I would presume it would come from informers, Chinese informers, people who were wandering around the villages. More of it would come from these people, communist terrorists who were caught and captured. That sort of business. But it was a very big program, and it was all levels. They had people on the ground ferreting out information.
You were talking about the good work of the 1st, 2nd Gurkha Rifles in Johor.
Yes.
Of the other regiments that you came across, were there any others who did especially good work?
Oh, yes. There were the Cameronians, who were also in Sagam at Johor area, under Colonel Bill Henning.
Why were they so good?
Because they killed terrorists. And also were very helpful to the jungle force. I always remember Bill Henning coming down to my company. We were going to do a joint operation, and we'd done all the planning. And Bill, who's a very fine fellow indeed, he'd been in White City in Burma, and he said the best thing that ever happened to him was poor old Wingate getting killed, because if Wingate wouldn't live much longer, he'd kill them all. You understand, there were no hard feelings. But anyway, he came along. He said, well, you know, perhaps I could come along. I knew exactly what he was doing. He wondered what the hell he'd been landed with. Four platoons of police field force. So they were all parading, getting ready to go out on the operation. And they were bloody good. They looked like soldiers. And I remember old Bill saying to me, he said, my God. He said, you gave me a surprise, Fred. He said, I thought I'd have a lot of ragged-ass guerrillas. There was a very nice chap there, a very good company commander, Major Jim Gawley. The Worcesters were before the Cameronians in Sagam, and of course they had a very rough time. They had about 39 men killed down in the jungle. But the best thing of the lot was, I think, early 1950, when the 1st, 2nd Gurkha Rifles hit a big force of terrorists just outside Labis, the Kim Chim Ho sawmills. The story, it may be apocryphal, but apparently the OCPD was rung up by the company commander. I can't remember his second name, Peter, very well-known chap. And he said, we've had a bit of a contact. Could you send some transport to help us bring the bodies back? So this chap said, oh, I'll send a light truck. He said, well, no, you should be thinking more about three tonners. We've knocked off 31. It was the biggest kill ever in Malaya, and there were pictures all over the countryside of this, in all the police stations, of this big kill. But the Gurkhas were exceptionally good jungle soldiers. They were long-term regular soldiers, superbly fit, superbly disciplined, and with extremely good officers, who have all been fighting in Burma. So, on the whole, we were very well served. And, of course, I had a lot to do with the SAS, who were then earlier the Malayan Scouts, then became the SAS, basically because when I was officer supervising jungle forts, they gave the necessary backup to the police field force forts in the deep jungle.
What did you think to the SAS, though?
In the beginning, they're a very ropey bunch, because when Calvert called for volunteers, all the COs sent all the rubbish. But once they got the Rhodesian SAS squadron and a squadron from the British Parachute Regiment, they were on the up and up. And after Colonel Woodhouse sorted out their administrative problems, because when Calvert was in command, far be it from me to blame him, but I think he had a pretty lousy bunch of people, and they didn't do the unit any good by flogging compasses and bits and pieces down in Singapore for booze. But anyway, the SAS latterly were absolutely first rate.
Any other regiments that you came across that you'd like to mention the performance of?
I'm trying to think. The Federation Regiment did quite well. They were, I think, formed from conscripts. The Templar's baby. Of course, the Malay Regiment, they were very good, steady soldiers. I never actually operated with the Malay Regiment. I wasn't in their area because I was mostly in Johor and then, of course, all over Pira and Pahang and the jungle forts.
You mentioned the being in charge, officer commanding the jungle fort. How did you think that that system worked in contributing to
our... I think it worked very well indeed. It was, I gather, worked out between the protector of Aborigines, Dick Noon, and Field Marshal Sir Gerald Templar. And this, as I think I mentioned previously, appertained after the colonists had been driven into the deep jungle, really deep jungle, in the main range, which goes up Gunung Tahan, for example, is about 6,500 feet high. And it's really very rough country there. It's very hard to get around it. Well, these Aboriginal people who inhabited the deep jungle used to grow all their food. They had what they call ladangs, gardens. And the communists dominated them and made them grow food for them. And it was felt that one had to do something about bringing these Aborigines under control of the government. So they established, I say, 10 or 12 forts. It might be more, it certainly wasn't less. But I was... after I'd finished a decent tour, sometime, I think August 53, November 53, I was appointed deputy superintendent and officer supervising jungle forts. I worked very closely with Pat Goolsbury, superintendent, police field force. The Federal Jungle Force had now become the Police Field Force. He was my boss in Kuala Lumpur.